The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, Benjamin Wittes here to let you know that The World as You'll Know It is a new podcast that features in-depth conversations between journalists and experts about the long-term effects of COVID-19. It's enlightening to listen to and has already given me a lot to think about. I'll tell you more about it later in the show.
I think that the real message that the Quad sends to China is that the four most capable states, the ones with the greatest intention, at least a growing intention, to counter Chinese aggressive actions, that they're sending this strategic signal that if you continue on this way, we are being forced to join together to try and deter you from further changing the status quo.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 20th, 2020. One of the most interesting strategic developments in the past few years has been the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad, the growing partnership between the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. With Secretary of State Pompeo's recent visit to Tokyo for in-person meetings with his Quad counterparts, it's a great time to step back and look at how this institution resurrected itself after a false start back in 2007, what it is and isn't doing now, and whether China is right to look warily at this dialogue. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio are Tanvi Madan, who is a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program and the Director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., as well as Lavina Lee, a Senior Lecturer at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, who was appointed by the Defense Minister in Australia to be a Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute Council in Canberra earlier this year. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 20th, The Quad, with Tanvi Madani and Lavina Lee. Let's start with the early origins of the Quad back in its first iteration, the Quad Mark I, if you will. Lavina, talk a little bit about the early origins here, going back to 2007 or so, building on the Trilateral Strategic Dialogue. How did these four countries, the United States, Japan, Australia, and India, first come together to start talking about strategic issues?
Well, I think it's acknowledged that the real instigator for the Quad in its first iteration was Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. He was the one who I think first met with Dick Cheney on a state visit to Tokyo and proposed the idea. And Dick Cheney in turn took that idea with him to Canberra. And before we knew it, from January 2007, in May 2007, so very quickly, there was the first meeting of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. Now, this was a really very low-key kind of affair. It was it didn't have a set agenda. It was quite exploratory, and it was held at the level of assistant secretary-level foreign ministry officials. Now, even before the meeting started, we had diplomatic demarches issued by China to all of the four countries. And China had protested about the creation of an axis of democracies or a mini NATO that was formed with the purposes of encircling China. So I think that was why the initial meeting was, in fact, very low key. Now, after that first meeting, there was no formal statement issued of positions by all four countries. But then again, in September 2007, we had a Malabar naval exercise, which was actually a very large exercise with 26 warships and I think 3 aircraft carriers that included all 4 countries plus Singapore. So it escalated quite quickly from a military exercise perspective. But then very quickly after that, it all started to unravel. We had Shinzo Abe forced to resign from office in September 2007 after only serving in power for 1 year. I think that was largely because of ill health, but also because of poor performance in the recent election. And then we had also the United States becoming more and more preoccupied with the Middle East and thinking about what its legacy would be in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then you had Australia, who also had a change of government in November of 2007, and a strong proponent of the Quad and also deepening relations with India was John Howard, who was ousted from power after being in power for more than 10 years. So you had most of the core proponents of the Quad leaving office. And in Australia's case, the new Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd from the Labor side, did a number of quite dramatic things, including reversing the decision to sell uranium to India. He talked about creating or avoiding uneasiness in Beijing. And it was our foreign minister, Australia's foreign minister, who stood with his counterpart in a media conference and casually said something like, we will be withdrawing from the Quad, and described China's concern about the QSD and stated that the dissolution of the Quad would be welcomed by all without actually consulting any of the other states. Wow.
So it sounds to me like we had this possibly dramatic incident in 2007 of this correspondence of interests moving towards this not only strategic dialogue, but, you know, on the water exercises. And within a year, it had basically fallen apart because of leadership changes. Tanvi, how was the Indian perspective on this, and how did leadership changes affect the situation between 2007 to 2008 and beyond?
Well, one of the things that happened in 2007 itself is, let me guess, that there was a kind of a confluence of conditions by the end of 2007 that made all the countries, I think, hesitate in some ways. And in the Indian case, it was some of the supporters of the coalition government at the time, who were the communist parties, who objected to the military exercise. And so to some extent, India also became somewhat hesitant. It also needed Chinese support. It was trying to get a waiver at the nuclear suppliers group at the time with U.S. assistance. And so each country, I think also there were leadership changes, and there was aspects of each of the countries having something in play with China. I think if I remember correctly, in the case of the U.S., it was to do with Iran's nuclear program. It needed Chinese support. And so you did see that this kind of China aspect in terms of consideration of that, other priorities took over. In 2017, and you heard the Quad discussed a lot in the meantime, at think tanks in particular, but wasn't really discussed very much. And then you started hearing in 2015, 2016, and 2017 some talk about it. I think most prominently Admiral Harry Harris speaking at a foreign ministry conference, the annual foreign ministry conference in India. He mentioned that the countries should revive the Quad. And there was little interest at that point. In the spring of 2017, President Trump on his part was meeting with Xi Jinping at the Mar-a-Lago summit. It was really in the summer of 2017, I think you saw a switch where there was a meeting of the trilateral strategic dialogue between Australia, Japan, and the U.S. at foreign ministerial level. And you really saw after that, you started hearing the Trump administration pushing for this to be revived, in this case, it was India who was the most reluctant. Part of India's reluctance was twofold. I think one was they were concerned that the Aussies would back out again, now that they hadn't quite seen the shift on China and Australia that is very evident now. But I think it was just starting to be visible. But I think there was also some concern about in the summer of 2017, there was a boundary standoff, as there is today, between China and India going on. So in the midst of that, there was some hesitation. But you did see that fall, I think, for a couple of different reasons. The Indians come on board. They were the most reluctant at that point. One, there was a sense after the boundary standoff with China that a trend that India had seen since about the post-financial crisis in 2008 was only getting intensifying in terms of Chinese assertiveness, and that they could not deal with it on their own. And so they tried two tracks. One was to work with China to stabilize relations, and the other was to deepen defense and security and diplomatic ties with like-minded partners, particularly Australia, Japan, and the US. And so I think this was part of that effort to revive the quadrilateral dialogue in November. And this was also, I think, in India, a way to, as this had a certain amount of uncertainty about the Trump administration, particularly President Trump himself, would he change his mind tomorrow? This was part of an effort to work with other middle/major powers to diversify, to as a hedge, not between the US and China, but as a hedge against US uncertainty. And finally, I would say there was an effort as well through the Quad to actually keep the Americans locked in to the region and to this kind of like-minded coalition.
Right. And let's talk about the motivations of each country from that resumption of the Quad dialogue in late 2017 moving forward. So from the United States angle, it seems it largely was seen as a China thing, even though there were, at least early on, statements saying, no, it's not really an alliance against China. But clearly, China was not being invited or involved in it. Lavina, take us to the Australian angle. From 2017 to now, what changed from 10 years prior, and how did thinking about the Quad change amongst governmental witnesses, amongst pundits, amongst the public? How has the Quad been seen in the last few years?
Well, I'd say that at the point where the Quad collapsed in 2007, there was a kind of more perception that China was still in that smile diplomacy phase of its mm-hmm. relations with the world. And yes, it had started some kind of assertive actions in the South and East China Seas. It certainly hadn't reached the level that we saw around 2010 to 2012 and now continuing. So the perception in 2007 was that it was too soon, that you were essentially creating an institution that had no real purpose and in fact might be counterproductive, instead of drawing China into the existing order and encouraging it to become a responsible stakeholder in the existing order, that the construct of the Quad might in fact push it to become more assertive and to create a security dilemma where none previously existed. So I think what in Australia's perception is just that China's behaviour has dramatically changed. Yes, there were seeds of that behaviour before 2007, but the escalation is clear for all to see. So the dramatic island building, the fortification mm-hmm. of those islands, the militarisation of them, the ignoring of the Permanent Court of Arbitration ruling in 2016, the blocking of other claimants' ability to actually assert their territorial rights. All of that, I think, has made Australian leaders think differently about mm-hmm. what kind of power China is becoming. Now, in terms of Australia as well, I think Australia, similar to some of the approaches that India has been taking, Australia is very, of course, very firmly embedded in its alliance with the United States. But there's always that fear that the United States is distracted elsewhere, and that Australia tries to encourage the United States to be as committed as possible to our region. So, you know, President Trump, his approach to alliances during his term has often complained about allies not pulling their weight. So in a sense, Australia views the Quad as a means of demonstrating our commitment to the alliance and a means by which to draw the United States into, in a sense, institutionalize its presence here, and to also contribute by having the four most capable countries in our region join together to support the extension of US primacy in this region, because we know that that is being tested already in this region by China.
Among Australian strategic thinkers, is the Quad put into the same bucket as the deployment of US Marines up in Darwin? Is that seen as part of the same dynamic you're talking about?
I think you could say it is part of Australia's contribution to helping the United States to project power. If we can help, we will. Of course, there are limits. We don't want to escalate things too quickly, but definitely Australia does see that the United States primacy is being challenged, that it is a strategy of China to ease the United States out of this region. So we're doing our part to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Tanvi, let's go back to India. You described how the thinking in New Delhi had changed from 2007 to 2017 and slightly beyond. But take us up to now. What has happened in Indian politics and Indian strategic thinking in the Indian Ocean and beyond that has, in a sense, elevated the Quad to where it is now with two ministerial level meetings within a year?
I think one of the things that has changed, which is very visible for everybody to see, is along the lines of what Lumino mentioned, which is a more assertive and in the Indian perception, a more aggressive China. And so they see the boundary standoff that has been ongoing since May of this year as a reflection of that more forward-leaning China that hasn't been, in their view, keeping to the rules of the road. That it is important in the region to maintain a rules-based order. And while they do not use the word China, they will find various ways of saying that it not just against India, which they see as unilaterally, you know, the PLA unilaterally changing the status quo using force at the boundary at multiple points. They don't just see that happening against India. They see the Chinese as over the last 6-8 months in particular targeting a range of countries. And so I think that the view of China has hardened. It was true even before the boundary standoff. I think COVID had an impact, the way the Chinese handled that. But I think particularly the last few months has hardened this view within the government, the strategic community, and among the public of a view of China that is a China that doesn't stick by the rules, doesn't stick to agreement, and cannot be trusted to stick to its word. And so you do see the view of China, I think, having changed. I think crucially, a couple of other things have changed. One is India approached the Quad in a step-by-step basis. It was, in fact, criticized for going slow. For a couple of years, we only saw kind of these twice a year assistant secretary level meetings. But one of the things that taking it step-by-step does is it helps build consensus within the country and within the strategic community, and also helps then take on the folks who have concerns that this is going to provoke China. Well, now that China is doing all these things against India and others, regardless of India holding back, the logic is, well, why are we holding back? And I think finally, the thing that has made, I think, a significant difference to why you're seeing the Quad continue, be elevated, expanded in terms of areas that it covers, not though in membership, is the changing Australia-India relationship. India's relations with the US and Japan had been fairly well developed, I think, particularly by 2017 or so. But despite being fellow Commonwealth countries, India and Australia, particularly in defense and security space, weren't really doing that much. But separate from the Quad, we've seen India and Australia over the last few years under both Prime Minister Turnbull and then Morrison really deepen their bilateral ties, diplomatic, defense. And I think that's made a huge difference in New Delhi's perception. And now they've seen 3 years of Australia having a pretty consistent view on China. So I think the change in the Australia-India dynamic has been pretty significant, where they now see Australia, whether, and they have an Australia-India-Japan trilateral, there's an Australia-India 2+2 ministerial with the defense and foreign ministers meeting. It has become kind of a deeper, more institutionalized relationship. And so, you know, Lavina will correct me if I'm wrong. I think the old thing used to be Australia and India was about curry cricket and the Commonwealth, and now it's moved, you know, beyond that. So I think that's been the other thing that in the Indian mind has really changed where it sees the Quad going. But I suspect, again, you'll see them take it step by step and not rush into things. But you did see a significant step, which was the Indian invitation to Australia to join the Malabar exercise. Some have seen this. The Malabar exercise is a US-India-Japan annual maritime exercise, started off as a US-India annual one. Japan had joined, started becoming a permanent member of that, a participant in that for a few years. Australia had been seeking an invitation to essentially make this a Quad exercise. India had been reluctant because of concerns about China's reaction and Australia's consistency. But you did see that now for the November exercise, India has extended that invitation to Australia. And while I think some people make that a litmus test for the Quad success, the Quad, I don't think it's the only thing that matters. But it is. It does show you, it to me, it's a reflection of how much India's view of not just China, but Australia has changed as well.
Right. Lavina, let's turn to the Japanese angle. As Thanvi told us, Japan had started working with the Malabar exercises with India and the United States. But in the last few years, Japan has seemed to be quite an enthusiastic partner in the Quad. How has their thinking evolved, and where are they now in terms of how they see this in terms of their multilateral relationship regime?
I'd actually say Japan is the kind of architect of the Quad. As I said earlier, about 2007, Abe was the initial proponent. And as he returned to power in 2012, he published, you might remember, a op-ed in Project Syndicate called The Democratic Security Diamond, where he advocated that the four democracies should join together to defend the global commons. And he connected the situation in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and talked about Beijing's desire to create a Lake Beijing in the South China Sea, to project power there and to block access for the United States and Japan. So I think that Japan is really the strongest proponent of the Quad. The whole idea of the kind of aims and objectives of the Quad being the free, open and inclusive region, that comes from Japan. That comes from their own free and open Indo-Pacific strategy that has essentially been adopted by the others. So Japan has seen, I think for a number of reasons, you could see that Abe has promoted Japan's standing in the world. He sought to make Japan a proactive contributor to peace, as they call it, which began with reinterpretations of the constitution, their pacifist constitution, to allow the SDF to undertake collective security measures in aid of allies and security partners. So that could have an implications for the Quad, to allow arms exports, joint weapons development and production to allies and partners for the first time since 1967. So they really are looking at the Quad as, I think, perhaps making up for the absence of a concerted pushback by ASEAN. We have ASEAN as the kind of central institution in our region, in the Southeast Asian region, but we're not seeing any concerted pushback by ASEAN. We know that it's divided and limited by its consensus decision-making. So Japan really wanted to bring the four most capable countries in the region to create a balance of power that is conducive to underpinning a liberals rules-based order. So I think the Quad serves a number of purposes. It essentially, Japan is limited in where it can act because of its constitution. It's still largely confined to supporting the United States in the East China Sea. But by creating a quadrilateral, and there is some suggestion that these constitutional interpretations and the idea that Japan could be involved in collective self-defense could actually involve the SDF supporting allies in areas of the global commons like the South China Sea. So Japan could push its forces. I think, you know, Abe, and I'm sure there's consistency between Abe and the new prime minister, that Japan should, in fact, try and support its allies where it can. And if China continues to act assertively, to act aggressively in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, that I think this more expansive view of what the SDF can do to support allies will continue.
Hi there, it's Benjamin Wittes here again to tell you about a new show. It's called The World As You'll Know It, a podcast covering five conversations that you need to hear about with real insight on how COVID-19 is shaping our future. The pandemic has already caused an immeasurable loss of lives and livelihoods, but in the midst of the upheaval, a new future is being etched out in everyday decisions and in bigger ones. The World As You'll Know It is the new podcast from the Aventine Research Institute, a nonprofit that invests in work exploring how today's decisions will affect the way we live, work, and experience life in the years and decades to come. This podcast previews and prepares you for these coming changes. For example, the vulnerabilities and inequities inherent in basic infrastructures, from supply chains to schools to healthcare systems, have been laid bare by COVID-19. Our minds have been opened to new ideas and possibilities in this entirely uncertain future. The World As You'll Know It dives right into how these decisions might play out through five in-depth conversations between journalists and experts on how COVID-19 might change the very nature of work, of cities, of higher education, and of the economy. So for deep, forward-looking conversations you don't get often enough these days, check out The World As You'll Know It, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Thanvi, you have posted to the Brookings website some interesting graphs and charts that explore the Quad and what it does and what it doesn't do. And in one of those, you talk about criticisms of the Quad on both sides, that it's not doing enough, meaning it's under-institutionalized, it does not have a robust secretariat and routine high-level meetings, and the joint statements aren't coming out regularly, and it lacks a unified purpose, but also that it's doing too much, that it will trigger China, that its partners can't possibly be reliable enough to follow up on what they are doing. You include in that it will exclude ASEAN. Now, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, if you look at a map, if you take Japan, India, and Australia, with China in the middle, just about everything between them, with minimal exaggeration, is ASEAN. To what extent is the Quad excluding ASEAN, and is that a problem for some of its stated purposes and goals?
I think the criticism that the Quad is excluding ASEAN has come from two sources. Some of it has been from the ASEAN countries themselves, who think that it will diminish ASEAN centrality. This has been fueled as well by Beijing's efforts to actually say this is going to be an Asian NATO, it's going to create instability, it's excluding you. And most recently, Wang Yi, who's in Malaysia, said as much publicly as well. And I think to some extent, you've had some criticism from people in America who do think the Trump administration has not paid enough attention to Southeast Asia over the last few years. And so you've seen that criticism come from two places. But I think if you look at the Quad when it meets and they don't don't release a joint statement, but each of the readouts talks about support for ASEAN centrality, its unity. They make sure and add that, which you didn't use to add it earlier. That's an allusion to their belief that China is playing divide and rule within ASEAN. But they also do, while they endorse ASEAN's role, in fact, they often meet on the sidelines of ASEAN summits. And so, that's very much part of their thinking. I think just the fact that the Quad exists is also a reflection, as Levina said, to their sense that ASEAN isn't being able or doesn't want to, whether it is because they don't want to take the heat from China, whether they do want to play kind of a more middle path role between the US and China, that they do not want to or don't have the ability to play the kind of role that the Quad countries are, that if you think about it, is like a coalition of the willing and capable, that they will not be able to alone, ensure this favorable balance of power vis-a-vis Beijing's actions in the region. And so I think you've seen them endorse it, say we're willing to work, with ASEAN countries. This is not supposed to be a NATO or an alliance. But I think the fact that it exists, the two things I think that you have seen some efforts to do over the last few years doesn't get much notice. But it's quite interesting that setting aside the US, Australia, India, and Japan over the last 3 years of the existence of the Quad have actually all deepened their ties with countries in South Asia, smaller states in Southeast Asia, and the Pacific Island states. Each one has made that effort. In some cases, the U.S. has as well, particularly with South Asia and with countries like Vietnam, for example, as well as the Pacific Island state. I think the second thing you've seen, and a reflection of that first effort, is that in the 2 weeks from around the Quad ministerial, you've seen Prime Minister Suga of Japan have trips to Indonesia and Vietnam. The Australian minister, Maurice Payne, on her way back from the Quad meeting, stopped in Singapore. Mm-hmm. The Indian foreign secretary was in Myanmar. And the U.S. deputy of secretary of state went to Bangladesh. So I think you are seeing these efforts to bring in smaller states as well. Finally, I will just say, you've also seen, because during kind of COVID times, the Quad essentially meet in kind of a very ad hoc way, kind of an opportunistic way, as they did even before the Quad ever existed. The four countries worked together after the 2004 tsunami. During COVID, at the deputy secretary of state level, there's a Quad Plus. They don't call it the Quad Plus. It's called an Indo-Pacific Coordination Group. Mm-hmm. But the Quad Plus, Vietnam, South Korea, and New Zealand having almost weekly phone calls to share information, to assess what a post-COVID recovery and a resilience program will look at. And there's another one at Secretary of State level that is the Quad countries plus Brazil, Israel, and South Korea. I think Japan might have dropped out of that one. But it just shows that I think they're very conscious in the Quad countries that they shouldn't be seen as an exclusive club, even though there is little plan to expand it in terms of countries formally.
Right. And despite that effort, Levina, to not declare themselves an alliance, to not talk about security guarantees, even to talk around the issue of China. China has not been kind to the idea of the Quad, going back to 2007, but of course in the last 3 years as it has picked up steam. Is China right to be worried, given that Australia will be joining in the Malabar exercises? Does China have a valid point here about the Quad being directed against it and, in fact, encircling it?
Well, I think it's probably obvious to all that the thing that brings the four countries together is China. I don't think we can skirt around that. Now, to talk about the creation of an Asian NATO, I think that's always been a useful thing for China to say, to discredit the organization, mm-hmm. to cast it as being the aggressor. But I think we all just have to remind ourselves that this is about as much about strategic messaging from China as it is about the Quad countries. And I think what the Quad countries are saying, and I think China, it kind of moves between either being scornful of the Quad, deriding it and saying, well, it'll never amount to anything. Or then, as you say, talking about encirclement and the creation of this Asian NATO. Mm-hmm. I think that the real message that the Quad sends to China is that the four states, the four most capable states, the ones with the greatest intention, at least a growing intention, to counter Chinese aggressive actions, that they're sending this strategic signal that if you continue on this way, we are being forced to join together to try and deter you from further changing the status quo. And I think that's the reason why Tanvi was mentioning yesterday's announcement that Australia would join the Malabar naval exercises. That has been a kind of symbol for many that, well, the Quad won't amount to anything because they still haven't done any military exercises. And here we are, we're at the position where Australia is actually joining. So they're moving forward with trying to develop some level of interoperability, habits of trust, military cooperation, which I think does send a clear signal to China that the ball is in your court. If you continue to exert your territorial claims in a coercive fashion, mm-hmm. that you are forcing the most capable states in this region to respond. So I don't think we're at the stage of an Asian NATO. We're not at that stage yet. But I think, again, it's really up to China where the Quad ends up.
And to that point, Tanvi, to bring this up to more recent events, just 2 weeks ago, we did have the ministerial of Secretary of State Pompeo from the United States traveling to meet with counterparts of Australia, India, and Japan. But the ministers did not release a joint statement. They issued readouts that were similar, but not in complete agreement in terms of areas of discussion and focus. Talk just a little bit about what was accomplished at these discussions and how you think they played it in terms of their readouts and their post-summit discussions about the Quad and where it's going.
So I think one of the things that the Quad hasn't done and does, as you said, get a fair bit of attention is that they don't release a joint statement. Mm-hmm. And that people have mixed views about that. I'll come to mine in a second. I think the first thing that the Quad ministerial achieved is the fact that it happened at all for three reasons. One, we're in the middle, and that it happened in person. One, that we're in the middle of this pandemic, and the most leaders have not been traveling. And for Marie Spain in particular, it would require pretty strict and long quarantine when she returned, and as she had been out of the country just prior to that. Even Secretary Pompeo, there was some talk about him canceling his whole trip. He canceled most of his trip to the region, but kept this so that the Quad ministerial would go ahead. So I think the importance of doing this in person was crucial. Second, I think that India agreed to this Quad ministerial in the middle of what continues to be a boundary standoff between China and India, which had flared up again. There was some firing at the boundary, at the line of actual control at the end of August. Mm-hmm. And the fact that India in normal circumstances, or not normal circumstances, but in another crisis with China at another point, India would have actually been more cautious, saying, we're not going to do a ministerial because it might provoke the Chinese. So I think the second thing that they did. I think the third thing that this achieved is that it allowed the four leaders to actually share frank assessments in a way that I think it helps in an in-person setting. To be able to discuss, and while they don't admit it publicly other than Secretary Pompeo, who said very publicly that the countries discussed China, that they did. If you read even each of the readouts, it was basically a long subtweet of China, which is that, you know, there was lines like, we believe in a region governed by rules, not power, or, you know, a region in which disputes are resolved according to international law. Well, I wonder who they're talking about.
That's not so subtle, is it?
No, it's not so subtle. And so I think China very much on the agenda, but not just China. I think there was a fair bit of discussion, apparently, on recovery and resilience due to, you know, in the kind of post-COVID atmosphere. What would the international order look like? This is a chance also to coordinate next steps, including, I suspect, this discussion about having Australia in Malabar would probably have been discussed there. Just briefly, why not a joint statement? I think it's because, so Deputy Secretary of State Began about a couple of months ago pointed out that the effort with the Quad was to let all four countries set the pace together. But it is true that the U.S. out of the four countries has, and the Trump administration in particular, has been very keen to highlight China's and particularly the CCP's behavior in the region. And the other countries are not comfortable doing that for various reasons. So they prefer to do this kind of allusion rather than accusation very publicly. And so a joint statement, I would much rather, for example, that they focus on the discussions at hand rather than spending those diplomatic resources negotiating a joint statement, particularly if they disagree on whether or not, for example, to mention China publicly. So this way, everybody gets to tell you what they want to highlight, and it's useful to actually compare and contrast the readouts, and so you'll see the different areas of focus. Australia, for example, mentioned critical minerals. So each country had thrown in something in there that is of special interest to them.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to close out with thoughts from each of you about where this is going. First, Lavina. Looking ahead for 6 months to several years, what does the Quad look like to you? Because we have the experience of 2007-2008, where very quickly changes in leadership and different perceptions led to no more discussions for quite a period of time, at the quadrilateral level at least. Whereas the last few years seem to be building up momentum towards, if not a more robust, fully fleshed out infrastructure and secretariat and joint statements, at least a sense of regularity in this dialogue and some of its related activities. So where do you see the Quad in the next few years?
I see the Quad as, you know, I don't think there's going to be a repeat of a demise of the Quad. I think there's a general consensus that China's ambitions are going to continue. President Xi's approach to the region, its ambitions for China's place in the world and how it goes about creating that position, I think all things that are going to draw all four countries even closer together. So yes, there's been much written about the slow pace of the Quad. We can see that it is in fact quickening and deepening. We had the first foreign ministers meeting last year, and now it seems to be institutionalized as a yearly event. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the next step of a prime ministerial or a leaders meeting is going to be announced sometime next year. Now, I think that what needs to be done in terms of the Quad is that the agenda is very broad, but I think it actually in some ways needs to be. There has often been a very unnecessary or unhelpful focus purely on the military aspect of things, but we can see good progress on Malabar, but also on shared logistics, on the possibility of joint development of capabilities. But I really think that an important aspect of the Quad that often isn't as focused upon is coordinating policy on things like the BRI, on infrastructure investment, providing an alternative to the BRI to countries around the region that might in fact be very vulnerable to that debt trap diplomacy that we have seen in places like Sri Lanka and the Maldives. And it's not just about providing the money, because it will be difficult for the four countries to be able to match the spending that China appears to put forward, but it can aim to facilitate the private sector in their four countries to invest in this region, to provide alternatives to those vulnerable states. But also it's about standard setting. It's about institutionalizing the rules of the road and defending the existing order. in concert with one another. And that includes things like infrastructure standards that actually benefit the countries of the region. So yes, Australia is very much concerned about standards and institutionalizing those standards at a global level. But it looks to Quad partners to do things like to reinforce supply chains in critical infrastructure, critical minerals, as Tanvi mentioned. So if you're going to ask me where I see the Quad in 5 or 10 years' time, I see it as escalating its institutionalization. I don't necessarily think we're going to have a secretariat and an organization in the next few years, but if China continues to behave the way it is, that I think is the future for the organization.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Tanvi, same question to you to wrap this up. Where do you see the Quad within the next few years?
I think the Quad is likely to remain a reflection of what I think we're a broader trend we're going to see in the region and perhaps globally, which is why I think people compare it to a NATO because that's what we are familiar with from the Cold War, an alliance system. But I think the trend we've seen, something former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter used to talk about, which was a network of partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I think the Quad is a reflection of that, moving away from kind of the American hub and spoke model of alliances in Asia to this kind of network of countries that are in different permutation and combinations, getting together to work together in coalitions on different subsets of issues. Issue-based coalitions, interest-based coalitions, however you want to think about it. And so I think the Quad will, because I think that is where we're going, you can call them floating coalitions because they'll all not have the same membership, different sets of, so, you know, Australia, Japan, India have a supply chain resiliency initiative, which they're inviting other members to. You know, there are people have proposed a D10 to talk about 5G, or somebody's proposed a T12. There's a, you know, global partnership in intelligence. So I think that you're going to see these structures. I think the Quad is going to be a key part of that. But I think equally important, and I think Lavina outlined where I think we see this going as the four countries. I think it will be crucial, though, for the countries to recognize that everyone doesn't have to do everything everywhere with just the four of them all together and not with others. So I think equally important is going to be what happens within the constituents of the Quad. So what are Australia, Japan, India doing in their trilateral? What are India, Japan, US doing? Australia, Japan, US have a trilateral. Then some of these countries have trilaterals with other countries like France, Indonesia, Korea. And so I think their bilaterals, the trilaterals, bringing in, working with other like-minded countries, European ones, but also other countries in Asia, is going to be quite important. I think as it develops, I'm not a fan of this getting, you know, setting up a headquarters or secretariat. That shouldn't be an end in itself. I think it should depend on what it is trying to do and work back from that. So, you know, the coordinating, the cooperating, and the kind of even just consulting with each other on various positions would be important. And we'll say one thing. I think it is equally one additional thing on this, and then I'll end with, I think, a test for the Quad that's coming up soon. I think it is important for not just kind of this Quad structure at the assistant secretary level and these ministerials to meet, but some of the things that they've been doing more informally, the ambassadors or diplomats in third country, the Quad ambassadors or diplomats in third countries meeting to discuss issues, or subject matter experts, so the cyber experts from the four countries meeting. These kind of things will be important as well to ensure sustainability. I'll end with the test that I think the Quad faces. And we'll find out very soon if it meets that test. As Lavina started off saying, you know, a big part of why the Quad died in the first place, or, you know, and, you know, that there's a, you could see some arguing that it could fade away in importance at least, there was a leadership transition. Now, the Quad hasn't really seen since 2017 a leadership transition. You could say Prime Minister Suga replacing Prime Minister Abe would be one, but that's not quite the same thing. It's the same party in power. Mm-hmm. And so with the election in the US, if there is a Biden administration, one question will be, does his administration see the value in this? Or do they see this as a Trump initiative? And do you have like an anything but Trump phase where they either do it because of the anything but Trump approach, or if they see, if they think that the Quad has been at the expense of, you know, bilateral alliances or Southeast Asian, or take account of Southeast Asian complaints on this. So I think that's one test, and I think we'll find out very soon. I think it is, though, it will be useful in that context for an incumbent upon Australia, India, and Japan to come to the US and say, you know, this is why we find this valuable. And it's not just a Trump thing, but something that all of us should collectively work on together, that it's a platform and not the only one, but nonetheless a useful one. But I think we shall find out very soon what happens in the election, but also if there is a different administration, what that might do.
Well, I think we should get back together in a couple of years and see how it develops and how our thoughts about it have evolved. But we'll leave it there for now. Tanvi Madan, Lavina Lee, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the podcast and rate the podcast, tweet about the podcast, post to Facebook about the podcast, help us spread the word. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo Studios is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.